All right, everybody. Welcome back to the That's Criminal podcast with me, John Stamp, your host. Today, I'm going to talk to Frank Stanfield. Frank Stanfield spent 40 years, actually continuing. He's been within the newspaper service for 40 years as an editor and reporter. Based in Central Florida, he's worked for the Orlando Sentinel, the Ocala Star-Banner, and the Daily Commercial in Leesburg, where he is still an active correspondent for that news service. He has what made me reach out and want to talk to him was he has a host of books. The one that jumped out to me the quickest, of course, was Cold Blooded, the case of the teen vampire cult in Central Florida. His newest book, which the title alone I had to be a part of, entitled Vampires, Gators, and Wackos, kind of a memoir of working the crime beat for 40 years. So, Mr. Stanfield, I thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yep. So what I'd like to do is first off, let's just start with your background. I saw that you served in the Air Force during the Vietnam era. Thank you very much. I also saw, you know, as I introduced you, it's you've been an active reporter for over 40 years. And we were talking before we started, and I gotta tell you, I'm fascinated by that as a police officer and as a agent with FBI and NCIS. I always liked the relationship that you had with the news, with the correspondents. I never really understood what you guys did. I understood that you covered and you wrote stories, but you go into what your resources are, sources, techniques, stuff like that. So if you could kind of give me your background and how you go about being a crime reporter, I think that'd be a great way to kick off.
Okay, well, it's all about relationships, you know, and it's all about trust. And I tell you, if you're starting out, if you're covering a court beat, you have to have that trust, because if you blow it one time, you're out, you're iced out. So people have to trust you. They have to trust you that if they tell you something off the record, you mean it, you honor that you have to be accurate. You can't be a wild man, you know, you can't be crazy. If you're meeting a journalist, things that run through your mind should be like, well, do you have an agenda? If so, what is it? Other than just tell the story exactly like it is. And I don't know, I've just been blessed because I will cover cases and cover a hearing or something. People come out and say, I don't get it. You just reported exactly what happened. Like, well, yeah. I mean, how do you embellish a vampire cult, for example? You know, how do you add on to that, for one thing? But I mean, it's just tell it like it is. And that's the thing.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny you mentioned, yeah, just trying to be the professional, the straight professional, write it like you see it. It reminded me, this goes back a long time. As a young cop standing perimeter, I had a guy nose his way through a guardrail in Charleston, dump his car right into the Ashley River. And I had a guy roll up on me, and I always got along with everybody. The reporters come through, very cool. Hey, make sure you get my good side, right? so this dude rolls up, and the bottom line was all the emergency vehicles were coming through my zone. And he's like, I just got to get up there. I got to get some roll. I was like, hey man, you can't come this way. I hate it for you, but you just can't. And he was like, no, I'm good. And he just ignored me completely and came within like a millimeter of just running over my foot.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, that's, you're pushing, man. You just can't do that. But you also mentioned agenda, and, never had to face, well, I did, I faced a little bit, but it seems like the journalism world gets a lot of bad rap anymore as being, you know, as having an agenda, as pushing a narrative. And it makes me wonder, because I know and journalism school is a big deal to people. Is there a code of conduct in the profession of journalism?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. Can you just kind of explain a little bit of that to me? And is there any like meat to that idea that everybody's pushing a narrative these days?
Well, here's the thing. What's happened is because our country is so divided that everybody just assumes one thing or the other that you're doing in politics. I mean, so my view is, okay, if whoever's in power, okay, then question them hard, you know, stay on their neck and make sure they're not blowing the taxpayers' money and they're honest and they're doing what they said they were going to do and all that. Fair game. But no matter who's in power, no matter what party's in power. So I know that the perception is that the reporters are all liberal and all for this or that or the other, but really you should just be whoever's in power, just stay on them, watch what they're doing and report exactly what they're doing. That's, if you do that, you're fine. And so not everybody has an agenda. In the editorial department, the editorial writers are supposed to be separated from the reporters. Okay. So the opinion people are, when I was at the Sentinel, they would be in a different office, you know, away from us, that kind of thing. It's important. I mean, they might ask us some factual material. They might say, well, what happened to this meeting or something, but they put their opinion on whatever that is. So yeah, there's a code of, believe it or not, journalists have ethics, okay? And it's like lawyers and cops. So they all have a set of rules that are supposed to go by. But because this country is so divided, we're just thrown into a stereotype, really.
Yeah, I don't want to get into politics or anything, but yeah, it seems like the whole world just faces a stereotype. The second you know, somebody's going to label you something, but that position of the, you know, ground pounding journalist is such a, like you said, keep an eye on everybody, report on everybody. And it's such a good check against, you know, and I'm not going to say all politicians are bad. But I'm going to say that, you know, somebody who's in a position where, you know, I want a Coke. And if they don't have tea in like 3 seconds, everybody's freaking out. There's a congressman in town. We gotta, you know, find the best limo in town just because they're a congressman. Mm-hmm. You spend enough time being coddled in that kind of environment.
Yeah.
You start to believe your own press, you know?
Yeah.
And, but when like the journalism, the straight up report it like you see it, such a huge check against any, you know, keeps everybody straight, keeps everybody in line. It's funny, the opinion room, like you said, I would have never put that together, because the opinion's important. Those are cults of personality, right? If we talk about Hannity or Maddow, whoever, whatever.
Yeah.
But having them separate from the actual, you know, fact-checking story, just reporters is, right. That's a very important distinction. It's actually a pretty healthy distinction, I think. I had no idea that was a thing.
It is. And cable, you know, cable and TV in general is different. TV, if they do a 30-second bit, you know, that's pretty long. 2 minutes is like huge, you know.
Yeah.
So they've got to compress it down. And so that's interpretation. So there you get into some interpretation there. And then the other thing is TV cable. That's a cable news. That's a whole different thing. Now you are divided into left, right, center, whatever it is. So I wish there was a good solid answer, but you just have to pick who you trust, you know, in the news business and go with them, really.
Yep. Yeah. If only the tough thing is that, again, you talking to you just, I've never really noticed it. I know that those people are opinion journalism, but they don't advertise it that way. So if somebody's not thinking of it, they're, you know, they watch whatever personality show is on at, right, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and they think they're getting their news and right, a very simple, you know, a narrative of this is my, you know, just a disclaimer would probably educate a lot of people, but nobody digs that deep anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. So you mentioned as a reporter, best job in the world. Can you walk me through, like, is it one of those things where you guys have a scanner? Like, are you on shift or something? And if you have a scanner and you jump calls, or you read through the docket at court and you sit in the gallery and just kind of wait and see what kind of stories pop up. Can you tell me how you go about vetting that? I mean, there, of course, something like a vampire cult is probably going to get everybody's attention, but the day-to-day of your community.
You know, it depends. It used to be, and newspapers have whittled down their staff a lot. They've downsized, laid off people. You know, they've cut sections out, and it's just a continuous thing. But it used to be, they had it divided up like the Sentinel. They had a cop reporter, they had a court reporter, they had an education reporter, they had a city hall reporter, they had a county reporter, they had all these different beats. Well, so now the way it is, you got to kind of cover more than one thing. So, but before, you had a scanner, a police scanner. And when I worked at weekends doing cops for the Sentinel, there would be like half a dozen scanners stacked up on a shelf. And you could, but after a while, you could pick out which one was talking, if that's FHP or if that's, you know, the city or whatever it is, you kind of picked it out. But now they've gone with some 800 megahertz scramble signals and all that. So you kind of have to rely on your sources to call you if something big's going on, that kind of thing. But the other thing is, what's good about the new technology is, like in the court reporter business, you can go online and look at court records. I mean, if Florida's got a really good open record law, the legislature keeps whacking at it every year, but basically it's still a good law. So you can keep track of things and people can call you and let you know things.
Yeah. So you sink your teeth into a given allegation and you're able to track it through adjudication through the end.
Yeah, like the vampire case. Let's talk about that just for a minute, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. No, I was going to get there. I can't wait.
Okay. 1996, just about 3 days before Thanksgiving. So over the scanner, and I wasn't working that day because I was off. I was taking care of a sick relative. So I was going out of my mind because everybody else is jumping on the story. But what goes out on the scanner is the call signal 5 is a homicide, and the guy's really excited, the cop's really excited, sheriff's deputy, and so everybody descends on the scene. It's this house in a nice neighborhood, it's kind of suburban neighborhood, it's a nice little house, it's got a swimming pool and all that, 5-acre lot near Eustace, Florida. So that's how that started. But, you know, as the story grew and grew and grew, and the reports come out, and there's TV there, there's radio, there's, you know, newspapers and all that. So then it just builds from there. So what happened then is, not only are you reporting on the initial thing, but because that was such a horrendous thing, what happened was the 17-year-old girl, she's a cheerleader, she comes home and she... she's late getting home. So she's trying to tiptoe past her dad on the couch asleep, she thinks. She goes into the kitchen, sees a blood trail. And so then she runs to her dad and realizes that he's been beaten to death. Her mother's on the kitchen floor. She's like just, you know, stabbed just repeatedly. So she calls 911 and she says, please send ambulances. My parents have been killed. And the dispatcher says, well, how do you know that they're dead? And she says, there's blood everywhere. And she says, oh, and by the way, but she says, and my sister's not here. She's only 15. She's not here. Hmm. So this is Jennifer Windorf talking, and her parents, Ruth and Richard, are dead. And so the cops get there and they say, okay, where's the 15-year-old? Was she abducted? Is she dead somewhere? Was she part of this thing, this horrific thing? And the more they find out about her, the more they find out, well, she was in this vampire cult. They go into her bedroom after they get a search warrant. They see all this crazy writings where she in her journal and stuff, where she writes about she feels like she's got a hideous soul torn in half and all this crazy stuff and all this correspondence with this vampire cult leader, Rod Farrell, who's only 16 years old. He's formed this cult. He used to go to school in Central Florida and he moved back to Kentucky with his family. And he came by to pick her up. So that's how the story starts. So the Sentinel sent reporters to Kentucky. We were just all over everything. And of course, I was, like I said, I was off that day. So I was freaking out because reporters are extremely competitive. We're insane. Yeah. Okay.
Missing the hot call.
Yeah. So, but I didn't have to worry because it would turn out to be a court story and it would be on my beat. And so, and this is Lake County, Florida, which is about 45 minutes from Disney World in Orange County. Mm-hmm. So we jumped, unlike most things, we jumped on every hearing, every piece of paper, we interviewed everybody that ever possibly knew these people. And we sent people to Kentucky. And then when they were captured 3 days later, we sent people up there. So it was just the craziest thing. And it made world international headlines. So it was just a crazy thing because these guys were in a cult and they were drinking each other's blood. Rod Farrell had worshiped demons and all this kind of crazy stuff. So naturally it's just a huge story, you know. But I'm a conservative guy. So the first time I write the story, I write in the lead paragraph, teen vampire cult, my hands actually stopped over the keyboard. I'm like, is this for real? And it was too weird not to be real. You know, Florida's insane anyway. You know, that's crazy. But yeah, so that's how it started. So we were very lucky but here's the thing with that story. And it's still going on. People are still talking about it. And because the Supreme Court keeps moving the ball on sentencing for juveniles and so on, the question is, did she have anything to do with it? Because she was not charged.
Ooh.
She was not indicted. Everybody else was. Everybody else has tried and so on. She said, and the prosecutor said, well, she didn't know her parents were going to be harmed. But, you know, on some level, she was involved in getting these weirdos into her family's life. So, you know, there's culpability and then there's criminal culpability. But, you know, people are still talking about this case. It's a crazy case. I've been on all these TV shows, talk about it and everything. It's crazy. But that's how it started.
Wow. Well, I mean, just to think of a 16-year-old that's got the charisma enough to drag people into demons and drinking each other's blood is scary enough to start.
It is.
How many people did he actually recruit?
Well, see, here's the thing. When he was in Kentucky, there was a whole bunch of these guys up there. The group he came down with, it was like there's five or six of them. And but there was up in Kentucky, there's a whole bunch of these guys. And that's how his mentor was up there. And then he accuses his mentor of doing it and setting him up and all kinds of, and it just gets crazier and crazier and crazier. And then the defense attorney, the public defender's office and the prosecutors, they came out with this press release. This has nothing to do with vampirism. it's like that police story thing where the guy says nothing to see here when the fireworks is going off behind him, you know, to see here, move along, you know?
Yeah.
And then the trial, it's all about vampirism, you know, because the defense was, well, he was influenced by vampirism and his mother was involved in it. And it just, oh, golly. So, you know, it's funny too, because, you know, a lot of people at the time says, oh, well, I don't read that stuff. But if you start talking to them, they know every detail, every detail. So they're reading it, you know, so.
Yeah, those that late 90s and 96 era, I think that was right before the true crime thing actually kicked off. Because I think that's right about when Douglas put out Mindhunter and Whoever Fights Monsters came after that. And it just kind of snowballed. You were right there at the beginning. But it's funny. It's funny. Nobody wants to admit it. We, you know, we keep our nice little, you know, nothing to see here. Let's not make it weird. And then let's go to court and be like, let's talk about our techniques of drinking each other's blood. And mentally taking over 15-year-olds. So she got off scot-free, huh? She was part of the cult and they just didn't want to, they didn't want to open that door.
I think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, I have to take, I mean, the prosecutor, he swears up and down that she didn't know. That's what she says. So, but you know, prosecutors don't like loose ends, and they don't like to give defense attorneys an avenue where they could pounce on. Here's the thing too. She didn't testify in the trial. So the judge, after the trial, and Rod is convicted and sentenced to death, by the way, at 16. He was 17 by the time of the trial. So that was later overturned to a life sentence. But so the judge says, you know, Mr. Prosecutor, I think you should call a new grand jury to look at this girl again. So they did. So they looked at her twice. And, you know, so if you read these books, you kind of have to make up your own mind. But, you know, what do you think, you know?
Well, and that's what I like, is that you just lay out the story. You're not offering opinion. You're not embellishing. You're just, here's what happened. This is all documented. And did she do it or didn't she? That's the best part of these types of things, is that loose end. Like, because if the prosecutor doesn't have a sure thing, you know, if I got one sure thing with Rod, why am I going to push and offer variables, you know, with this girl? I got a dead bang case. Why offer any option for doubt? So I get the tactic completely. But there's also a potential, you know, lack of somebody facing justice, which is, you know, makes everybody's skin crawl, especially when you talk about teen vampires. Yeah. It's funny. You froze up at your keyboard.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a straight shooter. I'm a straight kind of guy, you know. It's like, just tell like it is, but man, wow, this is so weird. You know,
I do have another question about sources. It leads me into talking about a couple more of your books. You sent me part of your advice to new writers. We got to talk about that, but I guess we could couch the idea of sources with talking about Dorothy Lewis. That's a tragic story.
And it is.
The simple fact that she, from what I understand, I didn't get to that one, but I'd love to hear her story. And I mean, it sounds like there was a relationship there, you know, a genuine concern for that well-being.
Yeah. Dorothy is an incredible, incredible person. The title is Unbroken, the Dorothy Lewis story. And here's what happened. She's a young widow in 1993, right before Super Bowl weekend, which had nothing to do with anything, except that's the time. So she goes to the grocery store with the two young girls, her little girls, and she's carjacked. And these teenagers say, look, just do what we say, nobody get hurt. They take her out to this remote area and rape her. And then they shoot her. They shoot her three times, once in the knee, once in the mouth, once on the neck, four times, and once right between the eyes with a .22. Knocks her out, not killed her. Because 22s do weird things. They're high velocity, small bullet. The bullet went in and kind of crawled around the skull area without penetrating the brain.
Yeah, they do that. They'll hug the circumference. It's weird.
Yeah. So anyway, she comes to and the car's gone, the girls are gone. Well, these idiots had killed her daughters. She didn't know it. She's wounded badly. She starts walking towards to try to get help. So she's walking along this road, and every time a car comes, she jumps in the ditch to hide because she thinks it come back to kill her. Finally, you know, this unfolds. Well, this one idiot goes in, he's the older kid. The one was like 14 and the other, and this one kid's like 17, I'm thinking, I can't remember. But anyway, he goes into the police station. He's going to blame his buddies to try to collect a reward.
That's right.
$1,000 reward. And he's being interviewed, and this detective's looking at him. He's telling the story, you know. The detective looks at his shoe. He says, let me see your shoe. And he says, and then the detective curses. He says, there's blood on this shoe. You did this, you know. And he says, how do you know that ain't ketchup? And he says, well, we'll find out. Isn't that disgusting?
That's a pathology.
You know, yeah. And so here's the thing. They have the trial because Dorothy lives. She's able to identify these people. And she's able to forgive these people. The older kid is executed. She didn't want that. Just, it's not going to bring my girls back. Her Christian faith kept her from being going nuts, she says. She ends up getting married. She was a widow at this time, a young widow already. She later gets married, has a miracle son. She gets off this anti-seizure medicine just in time to get pregnant.
Wow.
It's incredible. So this is the great thing about being a reporter is you see the worst of the worst and the best of the best. This is the great thing. I always kind of gravitate towards the victims' families, you know, because they've suffered so much. And here's the great thing too, is everybody wants to tell their story. And this is what happened, because Dorothy wanted to tell her story. And she went to a friend of mine who had made a movie, put out a movie. And this friend says, well, I don't know about a movie right now, but I know this guy. Well, I had covered some of the appellate stuff. Mm-hmm. So I already had a thick file on it. So, and Dorothy and I immediately hit it off. So we worked on this together. So she's just an incredible person.
That's an amazing woman right there. But it's called Unbroken. Yeah. I did make it to that one. I was midway through Vampires, Gators, and Wackos. Hadn't made it to Dorothy yet, but the source thing, you know, for me in my side, it's, you know, I got a hook into somebody. I can charge you can work for me. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, on the other side, we can pay you. You have to have those relationships, though. I don't know if what the Sentinel's budget would be in that sort of thing, or what.
We never pay for witnesses. We never pay for interviews ever.
That would have an ethical implication, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So what it is just trust. I mean, you go to the courthouse and you build trust with these people, the lawyers, the judges, the cops, everybody. They trust you, and if they don't, you know, they shut you out.
You know. Oh yeah. I did want to ask you about sources, but I also wanted to hear about Dorothy. So I thought those two would really marry up well together. And that woman, that's an amazing woman right there. And that's a huge service you did, helping her, put that down on paper. I can't imagine that was without tears.
She's just incredible.
Yeah.
She's so awesome.
Man. We talked about the life of the reporter that goes right into Vampires, Gators, and Wackos, which is probably one of the best titles I've ever seen.
Yeah. Some of the stories, the reason I said that is just, some of the stories are funny. There's like, for example, one night the cops roll up on this naked guy walking down the road, and he turns around and says, it's not as bad as it looks. And the cop says, no, it looks pretty bad. You're going to jail. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So there's that. There's some of that. But it's like Florida. Most of it, it's Florida. Florida all the time. It's like hurricanes. And I talk about hurricanes a lot in here because we go out. I was with, we had in 2004, we had like four back-to-back-to-back-to-back hurricanes.
I remember that.
And we were out in it. You know, I was with a photographer, and she says, I hope you're not one of these types that just want to stay inside till it's over and go out. And I says, no, I'm just crazy as anybody, you know. So we would go out in it, and to capture the story. And it was very interesting because it was just people do strange things. And storms make people do strange things, you know. We saw people out walking around, or but most of the time people are pretty sensible. But here's the thing: when you lose power, you're supposed to approach an intersection and stop, and people don't, you know, and they'll go out and try to buy, you know, something at the drugstore or whatever. It's pretty nutty.
Yeah. So that's the. Especially when the power goes out, it's like it puts that little bit of sliver of Mad Max into everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
People are like, let's do this. You know, I've been waiting a long time.
And so it's funny because, like I said, we had four of those things and everything was fine until the last day we were out covering the story, and the storm was over. And so we were at this trailer park. And so she says, I need to go back. We were in the office. She says, I need to go back and get something out of the car. So she goes back to the car, and a giant limb about, I don't know, 8 inches or so wide snapped and fell right beside where she'd just been standing. So you just don't realize how dangerous those things really are. They're bad.
Oh yeah, so, those things. Yeah, everything's up for grabs, you know, after something big pushes through, and you don't even think. But the last thing you're gonna be thinking of, you know, you're thinking of where's the next shot? What, you know, how do I get the next headline? And boom, there's a tree falling on your head.
And it's like when she's taking pictures, you've got to be on the lookout to make sure that something doesn't hit her upside the head while she's doing that. So you kind of look out for each other. It's kind of
Yeah, because she's got to focus. That's and I'm sure it rotates for you too. I mean, at some point you got to be able to pay attention to what you're trying to gather. Yeah,
absolutely.
So I want to keep going with that, and I want you to tell me about the time and how you handled beating the cops to the homicide.
Well, that goes back to the scanner days. I had a handheld scanner, and this was in my first job in Augusta, Georgia, and I was driving, just happened to drive right past this neighborhood. It was kind of infamous neighborhood. And the call goes out for homicide. So I just wheel in there. And back in those days, we wore ties. We even wore jackets sometimes, you know. So I get there and everybody's all riled up, you know. The whole neighborhood is just riled up and everybody yelling and carrying on. And I walk up with my little police scanner, and everybody stops and looks at me like, who are you? And, you know, you must be a cop because no other fool would come in here with this going on. So, you know, you kind of say, well, hey, how's your mama? How's your daddy? You know, you try to get some answers, because when the police get there, they're going to run you off, you know. But I was glad to see him come. I was very glad to see him come. It was one of those deals.
I'm sorry, continue.
No, that's okay. I have my advice to reporters is don't beat the cops to a crime scene.
Yeah, you might lose a little bit of scoop, but you're also, you know, going to be safely behind the crime scene tape.
Yeah. Well, that was another story. One night, there's this little town called Howie in the Hills, and they're famous for handing out speeding tickets like confetti. That's all they do. But one night they had a homicide. The call goes out on the scanner. A body on fire in a ditch near the cemetery. I'm going, okay, that's probably not true, but I'm going to go out there. And so I get out there, and there's one police officer, and he's trying to tape off the scene, and he's freaking out. Because he's not giving somebody a traffic ticket, okay? He's like freaking out. And he says, get back. I said, it's like right on deadline. I said, just tell me if it's true. Just give me something, anything. And he says, get back or I'll throw you in jail. And I'm like, oh man, come on. So I have to go. I call this friend of mine who lived in the town, figured out another way to go around the other side of where this was going on. About that time, the sheriff gets there and everything's fine. I call in something really quick. But I say, you know, then even the sheriff, they could have given me more of information, like the fact that the guy had a wooden leg. Just give me something, you know. Okay. They would help identify him, you think, you know.
Yeah, put the word out.
Yep. Yeah, just, I don't know. But it gets interesting sometimes out there.
Yeah, it's one of those things, especially I loved working at night. I always loved working at night because you have no idea what's coming. And that was just always the best. That was always the best part. You, no idea. And it always comes back. My favorite quote is by Wamba, and I would butcher it if I tried to say it, but it was to the effect that, you know, police don't go into the job to, you know, seek danger. They just want to be there when stuff happens. They're just want to be a witness to the world, you know, just want to be there when the crazy things go down. And it sounds like you got the same bug.
Yeah, that's right. I got the blue light fever, you know.
Yep. Yeah. I probably need to do that as a retirement gig, is become a crime reporter. You got me sold on this thing, man. Just haunting the scanner and going out and having fun.
Well, it's interesting too. Like I say, this is mostly Florida all the time. So there's alligators here. There's sharks. There's coyotes. There's bears. And every one of those guys will show up in the news sometimes, you know? And it's just the craziest thing. So, alligators one time we had over in Volusia County, which is the county next over where Daytona is. This is a terrible thing, but this little boy got eaten by an alligator. So the Sentinel, and I've done stories where like an elderly person was eaten by an alligator and everything else. Normally they're and a kid, but here's the thing. Normally they don't bother you, but if people feed them, they lose their fear of people and they're just eating machines, you know, they're just fierce. And so anyway, Sentinel had a cable show. So I went out with a photographer, with a game and fish guy on his airboat. And we're talking about alligators and stuff. And a 3-footer swims up to the boat. And so he says, do you want me to get him? I says, sure. So he gets him, he's holding him, and the little gator's like crying out, probably for his mother. You know, I'm looking over my shoulder where mama is.
Yeah.
So the wind is blowing us out into the middle of Lake Griffin, which is like just filled with alligators, just teeming with them. Looks like a Tarzan movie out there or something. And so we're in kind of in the middle of the lake, we're done. And the game and fish guy says, well, I can't put him loose out here. He'll just be food for the bigger alligators. So he says, here, you hold him. And I go back. I said, say what now? So I'm holding this alligator. And the photographer is laughing so hard, I thought she was going to fall overboard. So it was pretty funny. But this is Florida. And snakes, oh my word, they're just everywhere. And I'll be out working in the yard, and one of them will crawl across my feet or something, and I'll jump about 3 feet up in the air. It surprised me. I don't like snakes, you know, but yeah. most of them are harmless, but we got more than our fair share of big ones.
Yeah, I'm originally from upstate New York, and when I landed in the South, it was a very interesting thing that, like, you know, like the pollen wants to kill you down here, you know, everything from the spiders to the gators to the I was out at Folly Beach one day, I had a shark swim past me. I'm like, nah, this is a whole different place. But when you mentioned Florida, of course I mentioned with the kids and stuff, we journey to Orlando, at least once or twice a year, of course.
Yeah.
And we just like strap on the chin straps when it's time to get on I-4. Cause it's just wild. It is like, oh, here we go. You know, I can't even count how many times I've seen like tractor trailers lock it up right in front of me. I was like, here we go, let's do this.
Yeah. I always try to avoid I-4 at all costs.
Yeah. It's a wild place. And I don't know, maybe it's just, maybe the weather's too nice or something, but, people love to lose their minds.
They do. And I think, one thing is people come down from other parts of the country and they're dazzled by all they see, you know, all this Disney stuff and the sunshine and all this kind of stuff. And they kind of let their guard down, and bad things can happen sometimes to them. So that's a bad thing. But, and then people come here to live without their family. I mean, they've got no family ties. So they're, especially if it's a single male, a lot of times you're asking for trouble. A lot of these people are just lost, you know. And we had a guy in this book, I talked about it just briefly. He had this thing about Freddy Krueger. So he would be this Freddy Krueger character. He would like get these gloves and attach razor blades on the end of his hand and, you know, threaten people and so on. So they captured him and sent him back to New Jersey. I'm going, well, that's rare, because usually they come down to stay, nutcases, you know, in Florida. Yeah. But they sent him back to New Jersey. So, but yeah, it's, you know, mental illness is a serious thing. I have a chapter on, I call it crazy. I mean, I talk about a woman back in 1980 who drowned her three. She had young, two little girls, twins, and they were four, I think, and then a two-year-old little girl that drowned them all in the bathtub because she thought she was the Virgin Mary. So it's just, it's awful. I mean, the stuff that people do. And of course, that always bothers me when people do things to children or animals. That just upsets me.
Yeah, that's a same way. But it's but I mean, at the same time, like you've said before, the flip side is you get to see the best in people too. So every time you got some nut job thinking they're the Virgin Mary, you've got, you know, somebody running into a burning building or a car to rescue a stranger. It's so that's you get to see the good and the bad, which is great. And I want to make sure before we wrap up that I cover all your stuff, and I don't want to keep you too late. So we have your newest one, Vampires, Gators, and Wackos. Favorite title ever. And that's the one you mentioned where you go into beating the cops at the crime scene. Cold-blooded, the true crime story of the murderous teenage vampire cult.
Right.
And I completely understand how you're just at work, normal day, 9 to 5, and suddenly you're just like, I'm not writing teenage vampire cult.
Right. Yeah. That's the great thing about being a reporter. No, there is no normal day. No, it can be different every day. And that's what I like about it.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole way. That's an entire way I decided what my profession was going to be. I didn't want something normal. And that's how I landed. Yeah. And then we've got Unbroken, talking about the story of Dorothy Lewis, which is fascinating. I can't wait to get into it. How do people find you outside of Amazon or Barnes & Noble? Do you have any links you want to share?
Yeah, I have a web page, which is www.frankestanfield.com. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Those are the main things. So
excellent, sir. I'm gonna let us wrap it up here. I very thankful for your time. It's great talking to you. You're just your history and the stories that you've covered, I knew it was gonna be a fascinating talk, and I thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you. All right, thanks everybody. Thank you.